Yud Zayin Adar Sheni, Sunday the 27th of March, Rabbi Akiva Tatz, Spiritual Laughter. I'm waiting for the spiritual joke.
First of all, thank you again for this opportunity to participate in Torah Way. The theme, one of the themes of Adar is tzchaik, or laughter. Apart from the obvious observation that Purim is a time of laughter, the Sefer Yetzirah and the Gaon and the Arizal, they line up the months with different faculties. Parts of the body, of course the Shvatim, many other parallels of 12. But one of the setups of 12 is that there are parts of the body that correspond to every month, and faculties of the human function that correspond to the months. The organ, part of the body that corresponds to Adar, happens to be the spleen. I don't think we have time to talk about that now. But the function that parallels Adar is laughter. It's quick. Nisan, for example, is the right foot. Nisan is speaking. That's not so hard to understand. After all, Nisan is the time of Pesach. Pesach, that is Dibur. Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Each month has its own part of the body and its own faculty. Adar is tzchait, laughter. That needs understanding. First of all, laughter is not something that is life-sustaining or essential to life at all. On the contrary, it seems to be completely peripheral. So let's take a look at the subject of laughter, a very interesting subject, fascinating subject, very few makaris on this. Try to understand in a bit of depth what is the meaning of laughter and what Adar has to do. Adar is the last month of the year before moving to Nisan. Purim, what is the meaning of human laughter? See if we can penetrate that. How do you approach a subject like this in Torah Hashkofa? How do you begin to research such a subject altogether? And maybe the tools of approaching such issues, studying that, maybe is even more important than actually understanding this particular subject. But we have certain klalim. When we want to understand a subject in Hashkofa, we have certain klalim that we use. One of them, and there are many, but one of them is a knowledge that everything in the manifest world is a revelation of something in a deeper world. The Ramchal calls it a koyach nivdal. He says that everything that you are familiar with in your experience has a koyach nivdal. Of course, the koyach nivdal has a koyach nivdal as well. In English, if you want to give it its formal name, we say a transcendental force. The transcendental level has something that transcends that. That's the principle. Perhaps the easiest example to understand is a human being. You have the body, which is one level. There's a koyach nivdal, which is the neshama, which is always more real but less tangible. And of course the neshama has a neshama of a neshama, and so forth and so on. And he explains that in great detail, in the Derech Hashem. But the thing to grasp is, when you experience an external manifestation like a human body, it's there to teach you about the deeper reality. The purpose of relating to a human, you want, in a deep love relationship, in a marriage or deep friendship, You appreciate that the real person is the one inside, but the only way you can access the person inside is through the superficial, even though the body is entirely physical, but through its nuances and gestures and subtleties of expression, you get to know the inner being. The limit, of course, is to relate to the world that way. You should look at a tree that way. The experience we have of Hashem is only lefi ma'asav. We don't know Him directly, just like you never know a human neshama directly. But if you read the externalities, then you get to know who He is. That's the principle. So we have an axiom. The axiom is that everything you can ever make contact with, anything you ever experience in the external world, is there to teach you about the higher world. And of course the Mekubalim say, everything in the higher world, everything that was put into what we call Hashem's name, Olam Atzilus, which is the name of Hashem, is there to manifest something in our world. That's the rule. Everything in that world manifests here. It wouldn't have been put there otherwise. The purpose of a name is for those external to the name. Your name is only for me. You don't need a name for yourself. Your name is for me. His name is for us. It's a gilu to us. Everything in that name manifests in our world. Everything in our world comes from there. And here's the secret. You want to know Hashem? You study this world. You want to know your wife or your friend? You study the body. Watch its expressions. You get to know the person inside. And that applies to absolutely all human experience. Anything. Take a trivial thing. People get homesick. Chen ha-mokam ol yoshvav, the Gemara says. People ask the South Africans. People miss the place they come from. Even if the place they come from is not so nice. And they are in a beautiful place. Something tugs at the heart in terms of the place you come from. Why is that? Why is that? Well, if you're brought up in Western society and you're a child of evolutionary theory, you think it's because a few million years ago when you were a pigeon, you needed to find your way home. You know, but that's not the way a Jew should think. The reason you long for home is because your neshama is longing for its point of origin. The neshama longs for its point of connection with where it came from. But in the trivial world of our emotions, you translate that in. By the way, when people are home, they long to travel. But whatever it is, people like to buy things. People like to think about buying things. People like to look at the things they buy if they could, even if they couldn't. Why? Because the neshama is longing to move through the world and make genuine kinyonim, relationships, mitzvahs, Torah. But that's translated into the trivial level. Take a deep one. In Hasidus, they talk about dveikus. Dveikus means the attempt to bond the neshama with Hashem in such an intense fashion that you disappear completely. In such an intense love that you as an individual disappear. And paradoxically, in such an effort, discover who you are. What should that translate into the world of our experience? It's supposed to be marriage. Marriage should be two. The Ramban talks a lot about this. Two people giving themselves to each other so intensely and so fearlessly and so vulnerably that there's nothing left of the self. And yet something larger than the sum of the parts is constructed. And paradoxically, in such a love relationship, you don't disappear. You discover more about who you are. And what do you do with that newfound sense of identity? You put it back in. It's a lost art today, as any woman will tell you. But that's the point. So the principle is that if you want to know the deeper world, the higher world, you study this one. Let's do that with laughter. What is laughter? And the Torah is full of laughter. Yoshev b'shamayim yischak. Az yemala yischak pinu. Batischak liyom acharon. The Torah is full of it. How do you understand what the Torah means? Study it in this world. Study our phenomenon of laughter. If you analyze it accurately and perceptively, you'll know something deeper. That's the principle. What's imprinted in the Torah is imprinted on the world. The light shines through the Torah and projects itself on the world. You know the world, you know the Torah. You know the Torah, you know the world. That's the principle. Let's analyze laughter, spend a few minutes doing that, and see where it takes us. But our aim here is to reach into the deeper world, the higher world. Human laughter is an amazing phenomenon. Amazing. There's a large literature on this in psychiatry and psychology. And all the analysts of the human phenomenon of laughter have penetrated deeply into its nature and have all failed to understand what it means. Freud, for example, wrote a major work on laughter. It's called Der Witz, the joke, and its relation to the unconscious. It's full of anti-Eastern European Jew jokes, by the way. But it's a masterful analysis of what makes humans laugh that fails to understand, even attempt to understand, explain what it is in evolutionary theory that makes us laugh. Why do we need that? Henri Bergson, famous French philosopher, has an essay on laughter, a classic, very perceptive and amazing essay, perhaps the classic, fails completely to understand what is essential and what the purpose of human laughter. There are five theories of laughter. I'm not going to go into them now. There's a play theory, there's a catharsis theory. But all thinkers and analysts agree that there's one feature of laughter that's universally understood. What it means, they have no idea. And that is the incongruity theory. What makes us laugh is an incongruity. When two things are put together, they don't match. The result is a joyful, inarticulate expression that we call laughter. When a process goes in one direction and unexpectedly flips into the opposite, and you suddenly realize it wasn't going there at all, the response is laughter. That's the incongruity. And professional comedians know how to do this. They take you in one direction, and when you're least expecting it, in the sharpest possible way, you reverse the process, and then you realize it wasn't going that way at all. Right? That's the... Mother phones her son. Harold, are you driving on the highway? Yes, Mom. Harold, I want you to be careful. The police said on the radio, there's some crazy fellow driving the wrong way on the highway. He says, Mom, there's hundreds of them. When you realize it wasn't going the way you thought it was going, exactly the other way, And what's remarkable about this is a few things. First of all, humor is only human. Only humans laugh. It's a uniquely human phenomenon. Secondly, you can only laugh at something human. There's nothing a tree can do that can make you laugh. There's nothing an object can do that can make you laugh. Only a distortion of the human can make you laugh. If a tree looks like a person, it might be funny. If a person looks like a tree, it might be funny. There's nothing an animal can do that can make you laugh, unless it looks human. If a monkey looks like a human, it might be funny. If a human looks like a monkey, it depends what kind of sense of humor you have, but that might be funny. But you can only laugh at a deviation or distortion or perversion of the human. That's a fascinating phenomenon. Secondly, it's very interesting that what makes us laugh, when you analyze, is not necessarily funny. On the contrary, often it's painful, humiliating, embarrassing. When somebody at the moment of his greatest conceit accidentally slips on a banana peel and falls flat on his back. You have to be 3 years old to laugh at that. And yet even as you run to help him up, you can't hide a smile. It's just so ridiculous. What makes us laugh about things like that? And if you're going through it, it's not funny at all. Not at all funny. What is unique about human laughter that the onlookers find extremely funny, and when you're going through it, you fail to see the humor entirely? What does that mean? But the phenomenon of humor is an incongruous inversion. You hear the hippoch of Purim here. The hippoch of a situation going in one direction, then suddenly you realize that the whole, every detail was moving in a different direction, exactly opposite. When that bursts out, when that becomes clear, the inversion, the incongruous inversion, results in what we call laughter. What does this mean? Why is it built into us? Where does this come from in the higher world? And the answer is that the unmitigated tragedy of human history, and the Ramchal speaks about this in detail, when you finally realize that it's going not towards disaster and unspeakable tragedy, but that every detail was necessary to build a geula that couldn't have been without it, then az yamala yisroik fin. Not just because the trouble's over, now you can laugh, but the fact that the trouble's over in that fashion, that inversion, will be the result. Let me try to put it in its most brutal form. The funniest event in life is death. You know, we say this, vatischak leyom acharon. Here's a woman of greatness, spiritually prepared, and she can laugh at the day of death. What does Shlomo HaMelech mean when he says that? And by the way, why do we have a minhag to say that on Friday night? What is Leil Shabbos that invokes this? But the answer is clear, and the Rambam speaks about this in another context. The answer is clear, is that a woman in her flesh has been through that inversion. The process of birth is the most impossible inversion. It's an inversion from a situation of guaranteed death for two people that brings a new life into the world. That's vatischak. A woman who's been through that can, in her flesh, feel the experience of an impossible inversion. You know, who talks about this most explicitly is the Gesher HaChaim. Gesher HaChaim talks about the dinim of Loyalenu, death and mourning. And in Chelek Gimel, he talks about a person standing at a graveside, Loyalenu, burying someone, and what you ought to feel. And he says something remarkable. He says that in the anguish and the torment of the mourning experience should also be an emunah, that something begins just out of our range of vision that makes this existence pale into insignificance. There's an expanded dimension that we cannot see. And the way he explains it, he says, imagine two twins in the womb, living this idyllic existence within their mother's body. Mi yitneini ke yarchei kedem. Who could give me like those months that I spent in my mother's womb? Kimei alokai yishmereini. And they live this incredible existence, and suddenly these tremors begin and the one twin is born. The remaining twin begins to mourn for his brother who must have died. There's no way he can survive out there. His body's completely constructed in the opposite fashion that he needs. Little does he know that life begins only out there, beyond his range of vision. That's what you ought to feel when somebody's being buried, and to us it looks like a hopeless disintegration. But what he means is, and of course the Rambam talks about this, Rambam being a doctor, apart from being the Rambam, he talks about the experience of birth. Not only does it look like the mother's dying, you know, speaking to men, imagine you're a man who has no idea about birth. I've delivered dozens of babies, I can speak from personal experience. You don't have no idea how a baby's born. You think it has something to do with a stork. And you're wandering the corridors of your local hospital looking for the accounts department, when you accidentally take a wrong turn and stumble into the labor ward and you watch a woman giving birth for the first time. You know, you'd probably call the police. I mean, you'd need therapy. If you had to go through it, you would never recover. But that's nothing compared to what the baby goes through. The child in the womb has complete, he has an anatomy that supports his life underwater, 20 different features that keep him alive, each of which is guaranteed to kill him when he's born. And the features that keep you alive, if you gave it to the baby in the womb, would guarantee his death. Talk about a life. The child has holes in his heart. He has blood flowing in the wrong direction. He has no lungs. The lungs of an unborn child are little nubbins of tissue, never expanded. One of the biggest blood vessels in the body takes all the blood away from the lungs in the opposite direction. He's got blood vessels coming out through his umbilicus. He's got the wrong sort of blood. He has 20 conditions that keep him alive in the womb, each of which spell instant death when he's born. And of course, again, speaking from personal experience, you deliver the baby, you hold this little child in your hands, he goes blue. A minute later, he goes purple. He makes these terrible gasping movements. He's bleeding like crazy. A newborn child has about 300 cc's of blood, that's all. Bleeding furiously. Death is guaranteed within 2 minutes. And as you stand there helplessly holding this child, first umbilical cord clamps down like a cord of steel and stops the bleeding. At exactly the same moment, the holes in the heart close and the blood reverses direction. At exactly the same moment, the blood vessel going away from the lungs closes, the blood hits the lungs. At exactly the same moment, he takes his first breath, and about 3.5 minutes later, it's all reversed, and he's doing fine. That must have taken a good few orangutans in the trees during evolutionary history. A lot of chimpanzees in the course of evolution must have not made it. That is very funny. That is very funny. A woman who's been through that, who can experience the pains of a death experience, and know that the child's been cast out into a world where there's no hope for it. And then beyond the point of no return, there's a complete inversion. That's the issue. And when you look at Torah, you see that that incongruous inversion is everywhere. Yoshev HaShemayim Yisrael. Everywhere you touch Torah, you see the same thing. Purim is no... You know, the Medrash says that Haman made a noose, a gallows. The Medrash says he put his neck in to make sure it would fit. And the Malach Gavriel came down and said, suits you. It's not funny when you're going through it, of course. There's no humor at all when you're going through the experience. But the onlookers watching the inversion, the absurdities of, again, the word tzchok in Hebrew has many, many issues. There is a play element, tzchok and tzchok. We sometimes say Yitzchak and sometimes Yitzchak. That needs analysis, no time now. Marital intimacy is called tzchok. Yitzchak mitzachek is rivka ishtoi. That also is incongruent. The Kuzari says it's the most absurd human activity. Again, not the time to go into it now. Avodah Zarah, Yishmael, there are many other usages here, but the center, the core of the issue is the incongruous. Paro sits on his throne. Paro's issued a decree to have all the children killed. The Medrash says he had the Egyptian boys killed as well, because his astrologers couldn't tell him if the Redeemer who would usurp his throne would be Jewish or Egyptian. Of course they couldn't tell him. Moshe Rabbeinu was a little bit of both in some sense. So he's sitting on his throne. He's issued this edict that all the children are going to be killed. To guarantee that he cannot be on his knee, he's raising the child. He's raising the child. It's very, very funny. Not funny when you're going through it. Where's the origin of this in Torah? The first Jewish child born is called laughter. In case you think this is some peripheral issue. The first Jewish child. He's one of three people only who was named before he was born. The Medrash says there were only three people who were named before birth. Yesh, Avrim, Af, Yishmael, the fourth, needs discussion. To be named before you were born means that your name is a perfect description of your destiny. In Torah, always the name is of essence, but name before you're born, his name is totally of essence. And what is his history? His father's too old to have a child. His mother's too old. Ein la vlad, the Gemara says, ein la base vlad, she had no womb. This is a complete impossibility. And Hashem arrives and says, you'll have a child, and some child. Of course they laugh. Of course they laugh. They don't laugh in disbelief. Laughter is the appropriate expression of impossible inversion. And therefore, when it's impossible to have the child, and they're told that, of course they laugh. And the child is called laughter because he's born when it's impossible. But the story gets funnier. When he's old enough to have his own child, Hashem says to his father, that's fine, now kill him. Very, very humorous story, as you understand. And indeed, his father takes him, he builds him his bech, he puts his son and he takes the knife. You know, in Chumash, it's apparent that he was not killed. Avraham Avinu was stopped. He did not die. The Zohar says he was killed. The Zohar says, Ephros shel Yitzchak munach lefonai, the Medrash says, Yitzchak was killed. Well, the Zohar says, when the knife approached his throat, his neshama left. When his father was told to desist, his neshama returned. He stood up and made a brach of Mechaya Mesim. But he went through a death experience. And what's the result? What's the next incident in Chumash? He goes off to get married and founds a people who are indestructible. That's very funny. Because he's a child who's been put through the death experience, he becomes immortal. We begin where the impossible ends. Since then, we spent 4,000 years of human history where the Western nations trying, in a concerted, determined effort to wipe us out, and we're the only ones who're still here. That's very funny. We're talking about Yitzchak, last laugh. The Tikkun HaZohar says Yitzchak spells Ketz Chai. Yitzchak is Ketz Chai. It means the next world in this one. It means he walks in this world with his feet on a natural earth and his head in a totally different dimension. Yitzchak. The last love. You know, when you look at the Sherish of Golis, you see the same thing. The Sherish of Golis in Mitzrayim is the brothers, the Yosef. Another funny story. They sell Yosef, you know the story, we could speak all day about this. They sell their brother. They go through 22 years of torment. Yaakov Avinu loses his nevuah. The situation gets worse. It passes from one crisis to another. And finally it ends with a strange Egyptian tormenting them beyond all logic. They knew they were guilty. They knew they needed it. They knew they deserved it. But they had no understanding of what was happening. Do they know it's their brother? Yosef is putting them through a tikkun. He's making them go through exactly what they went through all those years before. And this time get it right. He's constructing a situation where all the evidence will point against the son of Rachel Imenu. And this time, with all the evidence, instead of dropping him, this time they'll stand by him. And the future of the world hangs in the balance. The family, the Jewish people, Jewish history, big stakes. And they have to get it right. He's constructing a situation that will bring them to correction and perfection. And they're going through a completely unintelligible torment. And finally they're on their way home. They've got their food. Mefarshim say there's always a cruel, disappointing letdown. An illusion of redemption. Like Moshe Rabbeinu goes into the palace. And the gates miraculously enlarge and the lions lick his feet. And he comes out and the Jews say, are we redeemed? And he says, well, now you have to make bricks without straw. Big test of emunah, always. And finally, at that moment of apparent salvation, hoofbeats behind them, the sacks are opened, Binyamin sack, that's where the evidence is. All opportunity given to turn on a brother again, this time drop him, and this time they don't. And they've just been attack in the whole situation, they don't know. They come back to Mitzrayim, they stand in front of Yosef. And there was no option. The Sfas Emes puts it very clearly. He says they had only two options at that time. One was to, when Yosef said to them, he's the culprit, he stays, you can all go. Binyamin, he stays. He's guilty. They had only two options. The Sfas Emes says they could either go back to Eretz Yisrael and kill their father. If Yaakov would have counted them in the distance and seen that Binyamin wasn't among them, he would have died of grief. Died of grief on the spot. Or they could have killed everybody. Yehuda said to his brothers, you each wipe out one city, I'll wipe out three, we'll destroy it. Mass murderers. Those were the options. Go home and kill their father, or wipe out everyone. And at that moment of hopeless despair, Yehuda stepped forward. And he said, I don't understand what's going on. I know we need this, I know we're guilty, but I have no understanding what this strange thing. But I know one thing. I promised my father I'd bring him home. And therefore, take me. You let him go, take me. At that moment of self-sacrifice, having unwound all the problem, and in their experience of complete and utter hopelessness, they hear the words, Ani Yosef. That's very funny. You? The source of the problem? The source of the problem is the solution? At that moment, in one instant, they realize that every moment of anguish is to be relished and cherished, because that's what brought them to their perfection. Not funny when you're going through it. The Medrash says they were paralyzed. They couldn't move. Yosef had to hug them and kiss them. He had to speak to them in Lashon Kodesh. He had to show them that he was circumcised. Not funny when you're going through it. But that's the humor. The humor is the inversion. It's the incongruous juxtaposition of hopelessness, of Golus and Geula. And when it happens, Keheref Ein. And that's the meaning of Yosef Hashemayim Yitzchak. That is the meaning of Vatischak Le Yom Acharon. very bizarre idea to us. Shabbos, of course, is the time we do that. When the week gives way to Shabbos, that's a premonition of the Geula. Shabbos is Me'ein Olam Haba. You move from the mundane routine of the week into the foretaste of Geula. That's the moment. That's the moment of birth. That's why we call it Chevle Mashiach. That's why our predictions of Mashiach are so dire. The Gaon says in one place, the Gaon says, writing in 1790, that the Mashiach will be preceded by a world war that will last for 12 minutes, in which a third of the world will die, a third will be injured, and a third will survive. Who knows what that means? Doesn't sound very funny. But Yitzchak means the last love. And that is the idea. The Gemara says, "As yamale soik pinu," the halacha we learn from that is, your mouth should not be full with laughter now. You have to laugh and you have to be happy, but you can't have a mouth full of laughter. Not appropriate in a world of tragedy. As yamale, not now. Always some degree of sadness to be aware of the suffering. But then, as yamale soik pinu means, when the whole thing inverts, then the mouth will be full, not just because the trouble's over, but because of the inversion. And Purim, obviously, is the time to understand this, is a process guaranteed to ensure the destruction of every Jew on earth on one day. And that generates the greatest acceptance of Torah ever. Every move that he makes to destroy us is a key to the acceptance of Torah and the survival and the greatness of the Jewish people. That is the, in the Hester of Esther, is a gilui that is hippuch, that is the result of which is laughter. And therefore, that's the pattern. You want a take-home message? What's the halacha here? The halacha is that probably, as a Jew, we should aim to be living upside down in the world. Live upside down. That's our aim. It's going to be hippuch one day. So we live upside down. Let them laugh now. We live a life of certain type of value, certain assertion of a connection to an invisible reality. Let them laugh, let them assert that all evidence is on their side. It's fine. We want to be living upside down now. Because when the hippuch happens and things are turned over, you'll be the right way up. And therefore, we march to a different tune in a different direction. Let me leave you with a story. After all, the subject is humor. I'll leave you with a South African story. In South Africa, there's a fellow who always does everything wrong. I don't know, here he seems to be Irish. But there, a certain fellow has got a certain name. So I'll tell you a story about him. He's driving in his car one day with his friend. They come to a red light. He speeds right through the red light. His friend says to him, "What are you doing?" He says, "Don't worry, my brother always does." Second red light, accelerates right through the red light. The fellow says, "You'll get us killed." He says, "Don't worry, my brother always does." Third red light, straight through. He says, "That's dangerous, what are you doing?" He says, "Don't worry, my brother always does." Next light's green, screeches to a halt. Fellow says to him, "What are you doing now?" He says, "No, in case my brother's coming through."